India surpassed China last year as the world's most populated country. But while its economy is the fifth largest in the world, it's only one-fifth the size of China's and growing too slowly to provide jobs for its millions of ambitious youth.
Raghu, in terms of the longer-term issues for developing our human capital, what are the measures we should take explicitly?
So, we have the best and the worst in India, right? That's we have fantastic kids graduating from the IITs who, you know, are gobbled up by multinationals immediately, who are capable of everything. And then we have kids in third grade who can't read at second grade level. And we have, you know, schools where teachers don't show up, where no learning actually takes place. So there's a lot of work to do at every level.
In today's program, former Reserve Bank of India Governor Raghuram Rajan talks about his new book, Breaking the Mold, India's Untraveled Path to Prosperity, with IMF Asia and Pacific Department head Krishna Srinivasan. Rajan is now the Catherine Dusick Miller Distinguished Service Professor of Finance at Chicago Booth and served as the IMF Chief Economist in the early 2000s. Krishna Srinivasan is also an author of several papers in leading academic journals and co-editor of recent books on the economies of Brazil and the Caribbean. Look for Srinivasan's review of Rajan's book in the September issue of Finance and Development magazine.
So, Raghu, thank you so much for doing this. Maybe we should just start with the title of the book, Breaking the Mold. Can you just walk me through that? What do you mean by that exactly?
Sure. I mean, to some extent, the mold is the tried and trusted way of development, which has emerged post-World War II and typically been followed by emerging markets in Asia. Essentially start with agricultural surpluses, mm-hmm. you know, start employing people outside of agriculture in manufacturing, and focus on not just servicing the domestic market, but an international market using your advantage in low-cost labor and the benefits of scale. So you produce at scale using your low-cost labor to compensate for the other deficiencies you might have in the beginning, such as poorer infrastructure
right.
and you know, institutional arrangements which are not adequate for business. But, you know, build on that and, you know, reinvest corporate surpluses in more capital equipment, invest national surpluses in better infrastructure, and invest household surpluses in better education and skills for your children, move up the ladder. So that was the tried and trusted way. You know, various countries did it with some, you know, differences. But first Japan, then Korea, then, of course, most recently China did it. And the question is, why shouldn't other countries follow this tried and tested path? And to some extent, what we're saying is the world has changed since China did it. Part of what has changed is China, you know, many of these countries sort of moved up the ladder, Dornbusch, Fisher, Samuelson sort of ladder towards higher skilled manufacturing. China is occupying both higher skilled manufacturing as well as lower skilled manufacturing because it has such a large workforce.
But it has vacated some space in the low skilled manufacturing.
In the very low end.
Yeah, low end.
In the very low end. But it does imply that the climb up is going to be somewhat harder. But the second aspect is the world is becoming much more averse to, you know, seeing its manufacturing industries leave for other parts of the world. And increasingly, countries are trying to retain manufacturing both through a combination of protectionism, but also, you know, by more automation, robotics, etc. So this path is harder. I wouldn't say it's impossible.
Right.
It's just much harder than it used to be because you're not competing at this point with industrial countries with high-cost labor. You're competing either with their robots or you're competing with much lower-cost emerging market labor in China or Bangladesh or Vietnam. And so given that, is that climb up the ladder as easy as it used to be? And the answer almost surely is no. Is it impossible? Almost surely the answer to that also is no.
Right.
But what other paths are there? And that's where, you know, some of the developments in services are worth taking note of, that selling services at large distances has become much more feasible, especially after the pandemic.
And here you're talking about both exports and for the domestic market, right?
Both, yeah. Absolutely. And so what breaking the mold is trying to say is, look, the climbing up the ladder from low-skilled to high-skilled via manufacturing exports used to be the name of the game earlier. It's about time we explored different paths, one of which could be, I mean, introduce an element of higher-skilled services for your export markets and lower-skilled services for your domestic markets, especially if you are a large economy.
So that's where the break in the mold comes in. So you move more towards the services-led growth in some sense.
Yeah, don't assume that the only source of job creation is going to be low-skilled manufacturing. You know, accept the fact that there may be other ways. And instead of seeing the what Danny Roderick calls premature deindustrialization mm-hmm. as only a problem, you know, a bug, think of it as a possible feature in new forms of development.
Right. So Raghu, actually, after reading the book, you know, halfway through the book, it almost looks like you're making a binary choice. I think talking to you now, you don't seem to say it's a binary choice, but it's more skewed towards services. So it's not really a binary choice, because that's a debate which is ongoing in India right now, focusing more on manufacturing and services. So here you're saying it's not a binary choice, but focus more on services. Is that accurate?
No, I would even put it a little more mildly. I would say recognize that services is a potential opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But India, like many other countries, does industrial policy poorly. And by no means am I saying now put all your eggs in the services basket. I mean, you're right in saying that when you read the book, it looks like that, partly because what we're doing is highlighting services as an alternative path. It's what is not usually considered, which is why we devote a lot of attention to it.
Right.
But what we're saying is, regardless of what you pick today, almost surely the role for government is to improve human capabilities. Because whether you pick manufacturing or you pick services, you need a higher quality, much better trained personnel in both areas
right.
going forward.
We'll come to that in a minute. But so one point you make in the book is don't subsidize manufacturing the way, say, India is doing through the PLI scheme. Now, one could argue that, you know, the PLI scheme is one way to get manufacturing into your country, getting FDI in, but it could have some collateral benefits by attracting other forms of FDI too, right? Some kind of a signaling that India is open for business. So why are you so negative on the subsidies for manufacturing, and why do you discount the collateral benefits?
So I think you need to be quite specific on how you see the collateral benefits develop, right? So one way of talking about the collateral benefits is some sort of agglomeration economies.
Exactly, yeah.
I bring that first set of manufacturing guys in through subsidies, then other people come in, and it becomes a virtuous cycle.
Right.
Now, the problem, however, is that it's not clear to me that the virtuous cycle is still present and going on. By all means, we should, you know, measure and try to see whether, in fact, it is happening. But we've had manufacturing before without a virtuous cycle. Remember, Nokia used to have a huge plant in Chennai, which used to make cell phones, which it used to export.
Right.
But we didn't see the whole sort of virtuous cycle build around it, which is component manufacturers come in, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you could argue maybe the scale wasn't enough. There's some scale at which it comes in. But people aren't making that point. And so it is possible to visualize a situation where you subsidize your way into a viable industry. But it is also possible to visualize a situation where the only reason you have an industry is because of subsidies. And the moment you take off the subsidies, it all vanishes.
But that's
right?
That's to be seen, right? We don't know that for sure.
Absolutely. But what I'm saying is, let's be aware that, in fact, this is not a proven thing.
Right.
And that unless we fix the disabilities, and that's why I go back to, let's fix the disabilities. including the quality of the workforce, including the business environment. So when you say signal, I would say subsidies are the worst ways to signal. Why not signal through a better business environment? Stop, you know, harassing foreign direct investment which comes into India because it conflicts with your intentions for national champions. Right? We have foreign direct investment, the Walmarts of the world, the Amazons of the world. Why aren't we treating them really well and using that as a signal to get more of that in, right? And so what I would like to see is, if you are interested in foreign direct investment coming in, focus on every aspect of it other than just the subsidies aspect. Because the subsidies aspect is just all too easy, and we're not counting the cost. I mean, where in the budget, if subsidies were the reason we had this explosion in cell phone exports, where are the contingent liabilities for all the promises we've made in terms of subsidies? I mean, I see numbers really small compared to what we think has been engendered by the subsidies. So I would like much more transparency, but much more of a focus on, is it bringing in all the other stuff that we need, or do we need more subsidies to do that?
But the broader point is improve the business environment, do other kinds of reforms, horizontal, vertical reforms as a way to bring in FDI. So one question, Raghu, in your which comes out in your book, is you don't quantify the kind of jobs and the number of jobs you can generate, you know, following your strategy. Suppose, let's say, break the mold, focus more on services. You don't quantify how many jobs you can generate, which is a big debate in India right now. A lot of commentators in India say that both production structure in India and those for exports have become a lot more capital intensive. And what we need is more labor-friendly production and exports. So the question there is, with India likely to add 14 million people to the workforce every year, do you think your strategy will generate the number of jobs that is required?
Well, let's start first with how many jobs manufacturing has generated. As a share of the workforce, manufacturing hasn't increased for the last 40 years, right? So forget all these fancy schemes. Mm. In fact, and the point you make is a very important one, labor-intensive manufacturing has actually shrunk. These sectors which are labor-intensive, like textiles or leather, have shrunk in the last decade.
And why is that? Why has India not been able to fill the space vacated by China in these sectors?
It's a great question, and I don't have an easy answer to that. I would say perhaps part of the reason is we haven't seen these as favored sectors, even while we're seeing the shiny, you know, chip manufacturing as a sector we should be in and willing to pay poor enormous subsidies there. We've neglected the fact that, you know, textiles create so much labor. Leather, of course, some of it is also because of our policies towards, I should say, the, you know, the source of leather. Who actually, the slaughterhouses, the meat, the leather, all that has come under a little bit of cloud in the last few years, which has hampered some of that. But I would say, broadly speaking, we haven't had a strategy on job creation in manufacturing. Some of that may also have to do with the skill base. When you talk to some of our industrialists, they say, I can't find people. And you keep saying, what do you mean you can't find people? We have tons of people. What they mean is they can't find people with the appropriate skills, and they're not willing to invest in training them up.
So that would also apply when you talk about your strategy about focusing more on services. Now, you talk about chip design, financial modeling, and so on in your book. But the number of people who can do that is small, right? So we don't have the kind of skills which is needed right now to pursue in great momentum the kind of strategy you're proposing. So the question is, how do you fill that skill space?
Well, so that's precisely the point of the book, right? That the first act is to focus on human capital. We have to improve the quality of human capital, regardless of whether it's for manufacturing or for services. That's why I think it's a no-brainer to say our budgets should focus much more on how, you know, on the one hand, we remedy that last mile. People who have, you know, high school education or even degrees but don't have really any employable skills. How do we create those employable skills? How do we create many more plumbers? somebody who runs a plumbing enterprise wrote to me and said, look, this is a huge issue and we're trying to focus on it to create people who have the skills in plumbing because mm-hmm. we actually have enormous demand for them and we don't have enough of those people, carpenters, plumbers, electricians. With urbanizing India, we need a tremendous number and that's a lot of jobs we could create, right? Right. That's on one hand. The second is, how do we create jobs for the skills people have?
Right.
That's second. So think about human capital. One place, as you know, where human capital creation is very important is at a very young age. Well, you don't need to have a huge amount of skills. You need to have empathy at that, to train very young kids, to play with them, to encourage learning. So all these mothers in villages who have a high school diploma, mm-hmm. could you employ more of them in the creches, the Anganwadis? That would be, given the number of Anganwadis we have, a million plus jobs. So can we be, first, train up people for the last mile? Second, create jobs for the skills people have, again, which can employ many more once we know where we need to go in terms of human capital. And the third aspect is focus on the more medium-term issues. How do we improve the quality of healthcare and education all around? And even that will require a whole lot of new jobs, right? Healthcare, for example. We've had this three-tier process for healthcare in India since pre-independence, the Bure Committee report. But we haven't actually done that in an effective way. What you need is, modestly trained first-tier healthcare workers who sort of can recognize basic diseases, but also know what they don't know, and kick it up to the second level where you have the trained doctors, and then kick it up to the third level to the specialists when they can't deal with it. But we need to make that more effective. And that requires training up both the guys at the bottom in a much better, more effective way. But it also needs many more doctors, and that requires more investment in medical education. One of the big problems is we don't have enough educational training institutions of reasonable quality for the kinds of needs that India has. So I would say across the board, instead of constantly lamenting that we're not creating jobs, let's seize the issue and say some things can be done relatively easily and some things need much more longer term investment.
So just on the relatively easy ones, can you say what are the easy steps you can take to generate jobs now?
So I think for the short term,
yep.
I think the whole issue of apprenticeships, which has been on the table, but not just have random guys offer apprenticeships, yep. but also measure how it works out, who creates job-worthy apprenticeships? Do they hold on to jobs? Bring industry into the process? Bring the ITIs into the process so that they know how to train people up last mile? I mean, create that last mile sort of skill building, whether it is in vocational jobs,
right.
but even, you talked about chip design. There's a firm which basically takes our engineers who have a basic understanding but have no sort of detailed understanding of chip design and has trained them up in the kinds of design capabilities that a firm like Qualcomm or like Broadcom would want.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially has created a whole host of these engineers who have the required skills, who can then be employed. There's that last mile value addition, which can be done to a number of graduates, but also to a number of high school people, which makes them employable. And they may be very different kinds of training, but we need to involve industry. We do need to involve the training institutions. And some of this, India has a very vibrant private sector,
right.
which is willing to step up in training, but it needs to also be given the right incentives, not offer fake degrees, but actually degrees that result in employability. So some kind of measurement process is also needed.
So what do you mean by incentives here?
Monetary incentives. You train these people, they hold on to a job. I will check 2 years from, when they get out. Those who have a job paying at least thus and such would then, we will continue sort of using you as a training institution, and we will hold some of the money that you have earned in escrow till such time as we verify that, in fact, you've done a reasonable job.
Okay.
I think we need to do much more of this.
But again, you know, putting the private sector just for a minute, if a private firm was to start training people,
yeah,
they will feel they might fear that I train someone, the guy gets a training, and 6 months later he's out to a competing firm. So how do you correct for that?
You pay for it. And you basically allow them first choice in the people they train. So if they do a good job training, they pick the cream of the crop. But the rest are out there, maybe working for the competitor, but you've got the best, right? And, you know, regardless, whenever you train, there's always the possibility that people will leave.
Right.
So you also have, in addition, to make it worth their while. So either in lowering their taxes or in direct payments, a partial stipend or a full stipend from the government to those people being trained. And of course, you want to make sure that they actually have a decent training program and they're training large numbers. And so, you know, willy-nilly, this will come down to using some of the biggest firms in this. But, you know, that's where you tell them this is part of your contribution to nation building. But again, it can't be just that. I think it has to be a mix of carrots as well as measurement.
Raghu, one last question. You know, in your book, you talk about the need for decentralizing power close to the citizen for securing what I would call a strong, durable, inclusive growth. Could you explain that a bit more? And how does that concept compare with what China was doing when it, you know, decentralized power to the provincial governments and allowed them to compete for investment and so on? So do you draw any parallels there, or how do you see that?
So there are many virtues of decentralization, allowing local authorities to have more power. There are some problems. Let's start with the virtues. The virtues is when you see a local sort of municipality mayor or a sarpanch, you know that the buck for local services stops there. Mm. If they're empowered to look after the local schools, if your teacher doesn't show up, you know who to complain to. You don't have to go to Lucknow, the state capital, or to the national capital to complain. You can complain to the local person you know. So that's a way for improving the provision of local services. You see that in India, the states that have decentralized more tend to have stronger local provision of services, health and education. I think the Chinese aspect was that the local authorities, when they are also sort of focused on creating growth opportunities locally, are going to be much more interested in attracting business and clearing the pathways for business, whether it's rural industry or businesses that usually set up in urban areas, but bringing them and clearing the pathway for them. That's what China did very effectively. It wasn't changing, you know, doing business norms at the center. It was, you know, allowing the local authorities to clear the way for businesses locally. And to compete with each other. So what we call in the book comparative cronyism. The comparative was very important to make the cronyism not becoming inefficient and a protection of local elites. But that leads to the concern people often express about this kind of localism, which is, aren't you empowering the elites? Wouldn't there be capture and corruption? And of course, this was a great fear of Ambedkar, one of India's founding fathers and the architect of the constitution, who basically did not want to go to the third tier. He left it at a two-tier country, the national and the states, but not the village or the local government, because he said that's a den of inequity and corruption. Basically, he feared the social conservatism of the village, where even today, in some, hopefully very few villages, lower caste people aren't allowed to drink from the village well and so on. So he saw that as much bigger at that point and did not want to empower the village to continue the kind of social oppression that used to exist. But my sense is we've come a long way from there. And now there may be more value to local expression and less of elite capture. But certainly there is a role for the center and for the state governments to make sure that corruption is limited, there's more transparency locally, here's how much funds we sent. You've seen all these experiments in Uganda, for example, right, about where the funds are sent and how they are spent. So I think the time has come for more localism in India, and that will help in many ways, including, most importantly, in the provision of local services.
So basically decentralize, empower, and hold them accountable.
Exactly.
Raghu, thank you so much for the conversation.
Well, thank you, Krishna, for spending the time to read the book. And thanks for doing
this. Lots of great ideas there. Thank you so much for talking.
Of course.
That was Krishna Srinivasan speaking with Raghuram Rajan about his latest book, Breaking the Mold, India's Untraveled Path to Prosperity, published by Princeton University Press. Look for Srinivasan's review of the book in the September issue of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.